All right, good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to be back in the Shir. I think, Baruch Hashem, to continue our journey a little bit in Sefer Tehillim. This Shir, this series, is dedicated by Leah and Natan Berry in memory of Eliezer Avram Svi ben Pesach Yaleib and Avram Chaim ben Gedalia. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the Neshamas will have an Aliyah and the family in a Chama. We also take the opportunity to wish a Mazel Tov to Leah and to Natan, who just had a baby girl, Baruch Hashem, yesterday. Mazel Tov, the Shabizocha, Legadla, Letorah, Lechopa, Ulema Asim Tovin. It's also important that we take note. You know, today is Yom HaZikaron. Today is the day in which Eretz Yisrael observes essentially the collective yahrzeit for the over 23,000 soldiers, police officers, victims of terror who have fallen defending the state of Israel. You know, I often say that unfortunately Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut have sometimes become such a flashpoint for divide within the Jewish community. What do you do? What don't you do? You say this, you don't say this. And the truth is, it's exceptionally silly and exceptionally unfortunate. A person could feel whatever they want to feel about the role of the state of Israel within the Jewish people. Is it the beginning of Geula? Is it not the beginning of Geula? Is it a further stage in Geula? Is the Medina perfect? Highly imperfect? It's good? It's not good? Those things are, to a certain degree, irrelevant. We have to focus on the fact that we are privileged to live in a time where Baruch Hashem, the only thing standing between us and Eretz Yisrael is the price of a plane ticket. You know, Baruch Hashem, for the first time in 2,000 years, when a Jew says, "V'sechazeno einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion b'rachamim," we say every single day about the return to Tzion. We are living in those times. And whatever speaks to you, to some people love to see the proliferation of Torah. Some people love to see the proliferation of agriculture. Some people are impressed by the army. Some people are impressed by the kolalim. It doesn't make a difference. Whatever impresses you, there's what to be impressed with. And Baruch Hashem, we live in exceptional times in which Eretz Yisrael is ours. The borders are open. We all know the government is highly imperfect because the government is made up of people and people are imperfect. So the government's imperfect. There are aspects of the state that are imperfect, just like we're imperfect. There's imperfection in everything in this world. But life is all about a choice, about dwelling on imperfections or ultimately being able to see that which is beautiful and that which is wonderful. And Shechianu v'kiyamanu v'giyanu, that we live in a time where Baruch Hashem, Eretz Yisrael is open to us, Eretz Yisrael is accessible to us, and Eretz Yisrael is under Jewish control. And we have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but we also have to recognize that this gift came with incredible Mesiras Nefesh, incredible sacrifice, and that the soldiers who are protecting not just Eretz Yisrael, but are protecting Am Yisrael each and every day are Mosir Nefesh. You know, at a time where in America, 17, 18 years old is the time when you are free from all responsibility. Is a time when in Eretz Yisrael, young men, and yes, also young women, pick up the mantle of responsibility. And so many of them have given their lives for the protection of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. And whatever a person's particular feelings are about the Medina, that's between you and yourself. But ultimately, again, we all owe a debt of Hakara Satov to all of those who have given their lives for Am Yisrael and to Eretz Yisrael. And we hope that Amir Hashem, our Talmud Torah, should be an aliyah for their neshamas. So let's begin with number one. We continue a little bit in Kapitel Nun Ches. So we're going to spend a few weeks on this particular Kapitel. But I just want to, we'll start first by kind of giving a little bit of an aerial panoramic view. So Lam Natzecha Tashchis LeDavid Michtam. So literally again, Lam Natzecha, as we've spoken about many times. So Sefer Tehillim was written by David HaMelech as his way of participating in the Beis HaMikdash. David HaMelech knew that he would not build the Beis HaMikdash. He knew that he would not live to see the Beis HaMikdash. So what does he do? He writes the music for the Beis HaMikdash. Sefer Tehillim, much of Sefer Tehillim, was David HaMelech's musical compositions to be sung by the Levitic choir when the Beis HaMikdash would be built. He knew he couldn't be there himself, but he wanted his music to play a central role. So Lam Natzech, to the conductor is the conductor of the Levitic choir. Al Tashches, so again, we'll have to define what these words mean. Lid David, Michtam. For David, a michtam. So even this opening phrase is quite dramatic on a variety of different levels. We've seen this opening word michtam a variety of times. So the Malbim, the Radak, explain that whenever you see a kapitel that opens up with michtam, it means that there's a message. Not only is there a message, but there is a message of eternal importance. See, I guess David HaMelech is kind of like you know, when you're in school. So of course, every student pays attention to every single piece of information. But every teacher also knows that if you really want your students to pay attention, what do you say? This is going to be on the test, right? This will be on the test. And everybody perks up. So the truth is, adults, we're not all that different either. So David HaMelech realizes we're running through Sefer Tehillim, we're learning a lot of lessons. And every once in a while, David HaMelech says to us, oh, by the way, really pay attention here. Really pay attention here, because I'm about to teach you something, says David HaMelech, that is of critical life importance. So whenever you see that opening word, michtam, that's David HaMelech's way of saying, this is on the test. This is exceptionally important. You need to be attentive to all of the kapitloch, but there's a lesson that we're going to learn over here that is mamish going to be life-altering, life-changing, and we'll see life-affirming. So what's the kapitel about? Ha'umnam. By the way, the other piece is, and this you'll see this will figure in maybe this week, probably a little bit more next week, is remember, we've seen often two different introductions to Kapitloch. There's Mizmor LeDavid, and there's LeDavid Mizmor. If you remember, again, this is going back a while, what's the difference between the two? So the question is, for David HaMelech, you know, in Chasidus, there's a concept of His Orusa de la Eila, His Orusa de la Tasa. There's inspiration that comes from above, an inspiration that comes from below, which is another way of saying that sometimes in life, we find ourselves inspired. Hopefully we all have moments of inspiration, and sometimes when you kind of try to drill down to it, to what is the origin of that feeling, you often can't identify it. Sometimes you just feel swept up by a wave of spirituality, wave of inspiration. Sometimes Rebbe Moshe gives us a gift. He gives us the gift of inspiration, and he just sends down divine energy. That's called his orusa, an awakening de la'ila, from above. But sometimes, and I would say more often in life, you can't rely on inspiration from God. You have to self-inspire. Self-inspire is called his orusa del tasa. This is very important because, you know, I was just having this conversation with someone this morning, actually last night. The challenge of Yiddishkeit today is no longer in learning, and the truth is no longer in observance. Because the truth is, all of learning is at our fingertips. All of learning is at our fingertips. Whatever language you want, however you want it. And the truth of observance also used to be a person has to choose between a career and being Shomer Shabbos. That is no longer the case. So what is the challenge of our generation? Is inspiration. Everyone wants inspiration, but here's the difference. We all want inspiration, but, what's the but? I want someone to give it to me. So I'm ready. I'll stand here. I'll even put down the remote. Right? I'm ready for the wave of inspiration to overtake me. But I want it delivered. I want it delivered. Inspire me. So that's not the way inspiration works. Inspiration, 9.9 out of 10 times, is if you want inspiration in life, you have to self-inspire. What Chassidus calls his orusa dilatasa, an awakening from below, an awakening from here. I can't rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu to inspire me. I can't rely on my rabbi to inspire me. I can't rely on my friends to inspire, my teachers to inspire. If I want inspiration in life, I have to self-inspire. So, orusa dilatasa. Why am I sharing this with you? Because remember, in Sefer Tehillim, when you see Mizmor LeDavid means David HaMelech was experiencing a wave of inspiration from above. LeDavid Mizmor means David self-inspires. This is a capital where, although it doesn't say LeDavid, it says LeDavid Michtam, this is a capital of self-inspiration. So already, even before we get into the theme of the capital, David HaMelech is already piquing our curiosity. Because number one, it's a Michtam, which means, again, it contains a lesson which is of great importance. And number two, it's LeDavid Michtam. Apparently, it's a lesson that came about not because of some wave of divine energy from above, but it's a lesson that came to David HaMelech ultimately, again, through self-inspiration. So what's the capital about? Let's take a quick look. Pasuk Beis, number one. Ha'umnam elem tzedek tedaberim misharim tishpetu b'nei adam. Is it true that you are silent about the righteousness that you should have spoken, the equities with which you should have judged the children of men? Af b'leiv olos tifalun be'eretz chamas yedechun yifalisun. Even in your heart you plot injustice. In the earth you weigh down the violence of your hands. Zoru Risha Mirachem, Tomi Betin Dovre Chazav. So again, the wicked become estranged even from the womb. Those who speak lies go astray from birth. They have venom like the venom of a serpent, like a deaf cobra that closes its ear, which will not hear the voices of charmers. Adarnal goes on and on and on. What's the theme of the capital? So again, it sounds like the theme that we've seen in many of the capitals. David HaMelech is being mistreated by someone. You know, again, in David HaMelech's life, the only variable is who he is being mistreated by. But at every stage in life, he is mistreated, hurt, abused, taken advantage of by someone. This capital seems to be of this same theme. He's talking about the deceitful nature of people. He's talking about people backstabbing. He's talking about the idea that people cannot be relied on, even those who say they're your friends aren't really your friends. So David HaMelech goes through this entire web of deceit. The obvious question we have to focus on is, so what happened? Right? Now, again, remember, we've learned enough of Tehillim to know that David HaMelech, already from his childhood, has to experience backstabbing, has to experience people pulling the rug out from under him, has to experience people taking advantage of him, people using him, all different kinds of things. But the question is, does this capital relate to a particular episode? So take a look at number 2. So in 2 and 3, really 2, 3, and 4, so the Malbim, Rashi, and Radak explain the context here. So if you look at number 2, the Malbim says, Lam Natzech al Tashcheis. So this word al tashcheis sounds like what word? How would you translate?
Destroy.
Destroy. So what does that mean? So the Malbim says something amazing. He says, Miusad al anshe shol she siso l'shol she yirdof sheinis acharei David. Va'amru she motza as kanaf mi'ilo. So the Malbim says that this particular episode comes on the heels of another dramatic episode. Remember, again, we made reference to the particular story where David HaMelech is on the run from Shaul. Shaul HaMelech goes into a cave to go ahead and relieve himself. Who's sitting in the back of the cave, or hiding in the back of the cave? David HaMelech, yeah. Right? David's soldiers are whispering to him, kill the king. Kill the king. The Rebbe Shalom has delivered Shaul into your hands. Kill the king. David HaMelech will not. What does he do? He cuts off a corner of Shaul's garment. When Shaul comes out of the cave, David HaMelech comes out a few moments behind him, holding a piece of the garment. And what does he say to Shaul? Everyone's trying to convince you that I'm running after you to kill you. Everyone's trying to tell you, they're whispering in your ear that I'm trying to depose you. If I wanted you dead, you would be dead. And what's the proof? The proof is I was close enough to you to cut off the corner of your garment. I was close enough to you to cut off the corner of your cloak. And he shows him the cut off piece of cloak. And in that moment, Shaul has this incredible wave of remorse. That's where he says, Bini David, David Bini, calls David his son. And he realizes, what am I doing? I've destroyed my family. I've destroyed my daughter's life. That's a different discussion. Mm-hmm. And all because I think that you're trying to run after me to steal the throne, but it's pashit. It's simply not true. It's simply not true. Now what happens after that? So things die down for a little bit. When I say a little bit, I mean like 2 hours. And then what happens? Shaul's generals, certainly Abner Ben and others, try to convince Shaul that no, David is really after the throne. Now, what about the whole cloth episode? They convinced Shaul that David, in fact, found a piece of cloth from Shaul's garment on a thorn bush. I mean, David he was never close to you. Your cloak must have gotten caught in the thicket, in the thorn bush, it tore, and David found the little piece. David found the piece. Now, this is not a discussion, but why are Shaul's generals so intent on doing that? Because remember, again, they want power. They understand that if David comes to power, they're out of a job, right? And they like their job. They like their influence. They like their wealth. So they will do anything to perpetuate the conflict. So, and amazingly enough, Shaul, unfortunately, is not well. When we say Shaul's not well, is that Shaul is consumed by a sense of grief, recognizing that he messed up terribly by not wiping out Amalek. You know, people in general deal with failure in different ways. Some people, when they fail, they say, okay, I failed. I made an abysmal mistake. I messed up. Let me regroup and rebuild. Other people refuse to recognize their role in their life debacles. So instead, what do? It's everyone else's fault. It's everyone else's fault. So for Shaul doesn't take the approach of everyone else's fault. Everything is just David's fault. It's not David HaMelech. He's just David in Shaul's eyes. It's all David. It's all David. David has nothing to do with any of Shaul's problems. He has nothing to do with anything that's happening in Shaul's mind. But again, Shaul, unfortunately, is too weak to be able to deal with his own life baggage. So instead, he puts it all on David. So remember, the moment that he has to forgive David is the moment that what?
He has to give up the throne.
That he ha- well, not even if he has to give up the throne, he has to do something even more difficult, which is deal with his own failures. So it works for about an hour. And then after realizing that, oh my gosh, I have to deal with my own failures, it's so much easier just to go back despising David HaMelech. It's, by the way, it's incredible how people are people. And even great tzaddikim are people also. And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to learn Tanakh. You say, oh, Shaul, that's crazy. It's not crazy, because we do it every single day. All of us have issues. Some of us have, I'm not saying anything specific, I'm just saying, you know, some of us have big issues, some of us have small issues. The truth is, whatever your issues are, they're big because they're yours. And the truth is, 9 out of 10 times, we don't deal with our issues. 9 out of 10 times, instead, what we do is, we find someone to assign blame for our issues. It's your fault. And the truth is, people go through an entire lifetime blaming anyone and everyone for everything that's wrong. And what they don't realize is, it sounds so tempting, right? Because you don't have to deal with it. But you understand, if you assign blame to others for all of your issues, then you've made yourself into a victim. And if you're a victim, you are totally powerless to control your circumstances. Whereas if a person says, no, the buck of my life stops with me. If things went bad in my life, it is my responsibility. I'm not saying other people don't contribute to it, but the buck of my life stops with me. As difficult as it is to take ownership over your failures, it's empowering. Because if I messed up and I ruined stuff, that means I have the ability to fix it. And the moment that I take the ability to fix it, it's empowering. Suddenly a person feels, okay, there's a lot of work and I feel overwhelmed by the amount of work that I need to do, but it's BID. I have the power to do it. If other people cause the problems, then I am powerless to fix it. And you have to, I can't fix my life. You have to fix it for me. Nebuch. Nebuch, a person who yields the mastery over their own destiny to someone else. So again, nothing to do with our capital, except that David HaMelech, again, so this, so if you look at the Malbim number 2, so the Malbim says over here that this particular capital is written after Shaul is turned again by his generals. So David HaMelech, essentially his capital is saying is, I can't believe it. I cannot believe what has just occurred. I just presented the king with incontrovertible proof that I had the opportunity to kill him, but I didn't. And the king had a change of heart. He forgave me. Again, we're not going to be friends. We're not going to be friends, and that's fine enough to be friends with everyone. We're going to go our separate ways. We're going to try to avoid each other to the best of our ability, but at least he's not going to try to kill me. So what happens? So if you look at number 2 again, Miyusad al Anshe Shol, Shesiso the Shol, Sheyirdov Shenis Achari David, Vamru Shematas Knaf Milo, Vazet Sienga Mizmor Zebishim al Tashchis, Venimsal Mizmar Akodem, Vahusad Neged Anshe Kazov Bali Lashon Hara. So according to the Malbim, he says as follows. He says, al Tashchis could mean either a reference to the fact that they say Shaul's cloak was destroyed on its own, David HaMelech never cut out a piece, or al Tashchis is a reference to the idea that they destroyed the peace. There was peace, finally peace between David and Shaul, and now again, men with a totally self-serving agenda totally undermine that peace. Rashi, number 3, similar idea. He says, Mizmar ze amar al sheba ala ma'agal asher Shaul shochev sham, velokach hasachonis vesetzapacha. So Rashi says, it's actually a response to the different episode. Remember, again, there's another episode where David HaMelech sees Shaul's camp. They're fighting against the Plishtim. David HaMelech sneaks in the middle of the night and takes Shaul's spear and his sword. He then goes back up to the ridge, calls out to Shaul, look, I was standing over you. First he gives Moser to the army. How do you guys, who's standing guard duty over here? Right? But then after that he says, if I wanted you dead, you would be dead. The proof is, I'm standing here with your sword and your shield. I infiltrated your camp. I stood right over your sleeping body. I could have killed you if I wanted to, but I didn't. But I didn't. So Rashi understands that this capital is a reference. So again, same thing happens. Shaul goes ahead and forgives David. Everything seems to be good, and then what happens? Once again, there are those who try, or not try, there are those who actively poison the well, and once again turn Shaul against David. The Radak in number 4 says, Ha'omnam ilim tzedek tedaberun, Amar ze kineged Avner ben Ner ushar sari Shaul, Shayashoftim as David kedin moreid b'malchus. So again, the Radak understands that it's not as much directed about an episode or a response to an episode, but rather a response to people. That there are those individuals who are constantly whispering in Shaul's ear that David is trying to steal the throne. There's a concept, without getting into the technicalities right now, but there's there's a concept of Mori B'Malchus. Mori B'Malchus means those who rebel against the monarchy. The monarchy in Judaism is an absolute monarchy. The king has complete control. Obviously, he has to work in concert with the Sanhedrin, the High Court, with the Kohen Gadol, but he is an absolute ruler. Disrespect of the monarchy is an offense punishable by death. I always say, like, when Mashiach comes and there's a restoration of Davidic monarchy, I think that's going to be the greatest adjustment for us. Meaning, you can't blog about the king, you can't tweet about the king, you cannot voice your displeasure about the king, because if you do it, the king speaks too long, the king speaks too short, you don't like his drushes. There's no recourse, because anything that's an affront to the covet of the Malchus, ultimately, again, is an offense punishable by death. So according to the Radak, Abner ben Ner and others are constantly telling Shaul, David is Morid b'Malchus. He's trying to steal the crown, and because of that, not only do you have a license to kill him, but what? There's like an obligation to kill him. So the common denominator over here, so really what we have is three different approaches, but they kind of all coalesce around this same idea, which is David HaMelech feeling an incredible amount of just resentment and anger over the fact that there are people actively poisoning the well. And why? Why? David is saying, remember, I don't even want the monarchy. I don't want the throne. Avner ben Ner, it's yours. I'm not trying to replace Shaul. And therefore, by definition, I'm not trying to replace you. The honor is yours. The money is yours. The covet is yours. The power is yours. I don't want it. Remember again, what's the only thing that David HaMelech wants out of life? The only thing. More than peace. More than peace. He wants to be left alone. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone. I don't want anything. I don't want anything. I don't want to be king. I don't want to be the king's son. I don't need any of this stuff. I just want to be left alone in this world. I'm happy to be a shepherd. I'm happy not to have any human contact. I don't want your money. I don't want your power. I don't want your influence. I just want to be left alone. And every single time he thinks that he has reached a milestone of peace in his life, someone actively comes along and poisons the well. This kapitel, which again, you can even look in the English, which is a very visceral kapitel. A very visceral kapitel, meaning when you look at these words that David HaMelech is talking about and the way he describes fellow Jews, these are all fellow Jews, it's quite amazing, which by the way is another interesting idea that David HaMelech teaches us about the need to work through feelings. Sometimes people keep things bottled up inside with the hope that if you keep it bottled up, it will resolve. We all know better than that. It doesn't usually resolve. It just festers. So what David HaMelech does, which is quite dramatic, is, I mean, he saved a lot of money on therapy because essentially he does self-therapy. The way that David HaMelech does self-therapy is through poetry. He expresses exactly what he's saying through poetic prose. He puts it out there. When you look at the way that he describes these people, they have venom like the venom of a serpent, like a deaf cobra that closes its ear. You know, let them be rejected. Let them walk as through water. He will aim his arrows as though they are cut down. It's a very strong words that he's saying ultimately again against fellow members of Am Yisrael. But this is the pain of David HaMelech. I don't understand. I don't want anything. I have no desire. I have absolutely no political aspirations. I want nothing. All I want is to be left alone. And every single time I think I get to that threshold of peace, it's not Shaul who undermines it, but it's the people around him who undermines it. And you hear David HaMelech's pain. But then something amazing happens. Take a look, still in number one, at the last two psukim. So number one, psukim Yud Aleph and Yud Beis, verses 11 and 12. Yismach tzadik ki chaza nakam pa'amav yirchatz b'dam harasha. The righteous man will rejoice because he saw revenge. He will bathe his feet in the blood of the wicked. So this is pretty strong wording. Bathing your feet in the blood of the wicked, like, it's pretty big stuff, especially that we understand that this is not talking about Amalek. It's not talking about Mitzrayim. It's not talking about Edom. David HaMelech is talking about his own oppressors. But look how the kapitel ends. V'yomer Adam ach pri latzadik ach yish Elokim shoftim ba'aretz. Then the man will say, truly the righteous man has reward. Truly there is a God who judges on earth. So the Mefarshim pick up on something dramatically amazing, which is the last pasuk is a dramatic shift in David HaMelech's tone. The entire kapitel is about the evil of, like, the incredibly, like, pervasive culture of evil that exists among some people. That's theme one. Theme two is the horrific punishments that David HaMelech wishes upon these individuals. And look how the capital ends. Vayomer Adam Ach Pri LaTzadik, the righteous man has reward. Truly there is a judge, God who judges on earth. Yesh Elokim Shoftim Baretz. So if you look at that pasuk is a pasuk of tranquility. There's a Pri LaTzadik, there's fruit that comes to the righteous. HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes care of everything. So the Mefarshim are intrigued by this shift in almost outlook of David HaMelech. What happens between the first 11 psukim of the capital and the last pasuk? The first 11 are intense. The first 11, you feel the anger, the resentment, the pain of David HaMelech, and yet the last pasuk is almost a pasuk of total tranquility. How do we understand that transition in David HaMelech's approach? See, interestingly enough, the way we're going to try to navigate this is actually through the parsha, through this week's parsha. So this week we have the great zechus to read Tazria and Mitzora, double parshios. So the Torah, both parshios, although Tazria begins with the halachos of childbirth, which we'll talk about in a little bit, the bulk of the parshios really is focused on the concept of tzaras, which we loosely translate as leprosy. So the Torah says, Ish tzarua hu tameh, So the Torah describes the individual who contracts tzaraas. What happens if a person contracts tzaraas? So the Torah says he has to let his hair grow. He has to tear his clothing, tearing his clothing almost as a manifestation of avelus. And badad yeshev michutz lamachana. He is isolated. He dwells outside of the camp. So the Gimar Maseches Erchin number 7 says, so what's the pshat with this tzaraas? So obviously, the fact that tzaraas is dealt with in this way, is almost a form of mourning and isolation, indicates to us that tzaraas is no simple physical malady. If a person gets physically sick, they're not isolated. A person gets physically sick, they're not punished. A person gets physically sick, they're not rending their clothing. So obviously the fact that the Torah deals with tzaraas by telling us that, again, tears his clothing, leaves his head, no haircuts, isolation, tells us that there's something deeper to this tzaraas, to which the Gemara says in number 7, Amar Shoba Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Al Shiva Dvaram Negoyim Ba. There are 7 different sinful activities which bring about tzaraas, but of course the most well-known and number 1 on the list is al lashon hara. So a person, again, there's not a lashon hara here, I'm just giving you a little bit of a background with this. So lashon hara, person speaks negatively about another individual, therefore again, they were stricken with tzaraas. Tzaraas was a physical manifestation of a spiritual malady. So if I was spiritually sick, person who speaks about others is spiritually ill, because happy, content people do not need to speak about other individuals. Happy, content people realize there's more than enough work to do on myself without worrying about or talking about other individuals. People who speak lashon hara are spiritually ill. So the Ribono Shel Olam goes ahead and gives, the same way that when a person gets physically sick. So again, there's a bracha in that, because that physical, those physical symptoms, right? If those physical symptoms tell me that something is going on internally, those physical symptoms allow me to say, hey, something's not right, let me address my greater health picture. Tzaraas was that same thing in the realm of spirituality. A person was stricken with tzaraas, that was a message from the Ribono Shel Olam, something is not right. Something is not right with your soul. Something is not right in the spiritual state of affairs. It's time for you to take a step back and analyze how you're living. So if you look at number 9, the Sefer HaChinuch says something really amazing. Sefer HaChinuch writes, he asks, so what is the message in tzaraas? What is the message in this halacha? So he writes, Mishrashi HaMitzvah Likboa B'nafshosenu Ki Ashkachas Hashem Baruch Hu Pratit Al Kol Echod Ve'Echod Mibnei Adam. So Sefer HaChinuch says something amazing. You know what the message of tzaraas is? The message of tzaraas is hashgacha pratis, is divine providence, and more specifically, divine involvement in every detail of our lives. What does tzaraas tell me? That the Ribono Shel Olam is even more effective than the NSA, right? Who knows what the NSA is monitoring, right? But at the end of the day, Hashem Baruch Hu, mamish, He's involved in my daily conversations. He's involved in the way I speak to others. Again, he hears the words that I say. So when I'm stricken with tzaras, what that means is the king of the universe knows that I spoke ill of another individual. So you see, we often think that the message of tzaras is how bad Lashon Hara is. That's true. Lashon Hara is bad. But we have other psukim in the Torah that teach us about the depravity of Lashon Hara. That's not the message of tzaras. The message of tzaras is Hashkacha Pratis, if divine involvement in even the smallest details of my life. Because if I'm getting tzaras, that means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is monitoring, or is, monitoring is the wrong word, is listening, right, is attentive to the words that are coming out of my mouth. Really? I'm one person in a world of billions of people in a universe that we, who knows how vast it is, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is listening to the words that I'm saying to my friend. So since the Sefer HaChinuch, that's the message. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actively involved. So this is actually quite interesting. He says, look at paragraph Dalit. This is not really our primary topic for today. I'm whetting your appetite with this, because this is actually, this Sefer HaChinuch opens the door for some incredibly overwhelming and fierce theological debate. Take a look at letter Dalit. He says, Sheyish kitos b'nei adam yachshivu, ki ashkochas Hashem baruch hu akol aminim b'prat. Bein anoshim o shar bali chayim v'yesh men kitosh yachshu ki hashkachas Hashem al kol inyanei ha'olam. Because the Sefer HaChinuch says, and if I would say it, you would call me an apikoris, but the Sefer HaChinuch says, he says, there are some people that think hashkacha pratis, God governs every last detail. Bein bali chayim o shar dvarim. Kolomar, shelo yisnonea davar echad katam ba'olam hazeh, rak bechevtso baruchu b'gzeirasa. There are some people who think that Hashkacha Pratis means that God is involved in every single last, smallest, minute detail. Achshivu ki binfal ala echad mina ilon hu gazer alav sheyipol. To the point that they think that what? That if a leaf falls off a tree, how does a leaf fall off a tree? That's the Ribon Sha'olam. V'i efshar sheyis acher o yaktim zman nefilas afilu rega. And again, they think, oh, that, you know, Mamish, we just saw something amazing. The leaf fell off the tree. The Ribbono Shel Olam ordained that this moment it falls off, not one moment earlier, not one moment later. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, v'zeh da'as rachok harbe min hasechel. Sefer HaChinuch says, that makes no sense. That makes no sense. The Sefer HaChinuch over here is quoting different schools of thought in the realm of Hashkacha Pratis. The Sefer HaChinuch himself does not subscribe, we'll call it, to the leaf approach, right? Which is that even when the leaf falls off the tree, the Sefer HaChinuch's approach is, the Rosh Hashanah created a world. The world has nature. And nature runs. Of course, the Kaddish Baruch Hu goes ahead, is God actively involved in when the leaves fall off the tree? Well, the Sefer HaChinuch says, no. He's not, God's involved in everything. But it's not the pshat that the Ribbono Shel Olam is like, okay, now. That's not how HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. Again, I'm saying this to you because there are others who vehemently disagree with the Sefer HaChinuch and say, no, Hashgacha Pratis means that the Ribbono Shel Olam is involved. I'll call Prat Uprat. You know, the Sefer HaChinuch gives, I think I've mentioned this before, he gives the famous mashal. Imagine for a moment if a person is walking down a path, and the path is lined on both sides by thorn bushes. And a person goes ahead and walks close to the thorns and scratches their arm. Is that Hashkacha Pratis? No. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, no. That's called carelessness. You should have been a little bit more mindful where you are. Don't get God involved in this. Right? It has nothing to do with God. This is either I drank too much or I'm not paying attention. Whatever it is, I'm not walking a straight line. That's why I got caught. That's not Hashkacha Pratis. So the Sefer HaChinuch says over here something amazing. He says there's this very fine line. Is the Ribbono Shel Olam involved in every single one of the most minute details of the world? Sefer HaChinuch holds no. Sefer HaChinuch holds no. If I cut my arm, that's me. The leaf falls off the tree. That's just nature. What he is involved in high level human activity, how I talk, is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when I say involved, I don't mean that he's moving my mouth. I mean that he is attentive to these processes and weighs in on how it is that I am conducting myself in this area of life. Therefore, says the Sefer HaChinuch, the entire message of tzara'as is hashgacha pratis. The Ribono Shel Olam is involved in my life. And lest you doubt that for that just a moment, if I say the wrong thing with malicious intent, the Ribono Shel Olam gets involved in this situation. So again, this is so profound, because so often the discussion about Saras is always about Lashon Hara, Lashon Hara, Lashon Hara. I'm going to go on record. Lashon Hara is bad. And that's not even a machlokes. Everyone agrees with that one. Maybe the one thing in Yiddishkeit. Besides that, there's one HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? That, Lashon Hara is bad. But that's not the take-home message of Saras. The take-home message of Saras is Hashkacha Pratis, of divine involvement in daily human activity. Whether God's involved in the leaf falling off the tree, if I'm walking too close to the thorn bush, that's subject for dispute. That's a theological dispute. But he's involved actively in my day-to-day activities of daily living. So Kadosh Baruch Hu ultimately, again, is tapping me on the shoulder when I get Saras. He's telling me, hey, I'm a part of your life. I've seen the way you're living. I see what you're doing. I'm going to ask you essentially to take a time out. You need to remove yourself from the world a little bit, and you need to think about what you're doing and how you're doing it. You need to go ahead and really try to figure out where you've lost your way in life. That's Saras. I'll tell you something amazing. Take a look at number 10. So later on in the parasha, the Torah speaks about another form of Saras, which is Vaidabra Hashem al Moshe al Aaron Limar. Ki savo el eretz kinan asher ani nosin la'achuza, v'nasati negat tzara'as b'beis eretz achuzaschem. So what happens? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu here speaks about what we call tzara'as habayis. God says, when we come to Eretz Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give us the land as an achuza, and I will place tzara'as in your homes. Okay? So Rashi HaKadosh number 11 says, v'nasati negat tzara'as, now, what's interesting is the following. If you look at this pasuk, the pasuk makes it sound like that's what? That Saras is going to happen. Now remember, I want to contrast that, because remember again, the Torah discusses Ish Tzaruhu, Tami, when it talks about original Saras, it's an if discussion. If you contract Saras, here is the process. When it comes ultimately to Saras of the home, the Torah almost frames it as a fait accompli, almost frames it as something that is going to happen. So Rashi HaKadosh number 11 says, Besora Hilayim, Shana Goyim Baim Aleihem. God is telling us that there's going to be Saras in the homes. Why? Lefi Shehet Minu Amoroim Matmonios Shal Zahav Bikiros Bateihem. Because when the Jews left Egypt, and the seven indigenous Canaanite nations heard that Kali Yisrael was happening, so they knew that they were going to be kicked out of their land, or they were going to be kicked out of our land. So what did they do? They hid their wealth. Where did they hide their wealth? They hid their wealth in the walls of their homes, thinking that the Jews aren't going to destroy the homes. They'll live in the homes, and one day if we have the opportunity to come back, will reclaim that wealth. So they hid the wealth in the homes. Shalar Bam Shan Shay Yisrael Midbar Va'ayideh Hanega. Notates habayis umotzan. So again, very quickly, what happens with saras habayis? A person comes home and they find that there is some type of saras discoloration on the stones of the house. So what do you do? What's the halacha? You remove the stones. Again, if the saras becomes too pervasive, you may have to demolish the structure. But on a basic level, you remove the stones. So what's the chaper of removing the stones? So the great part is that what? When you remove the stones, you'll find all of the hidden treasure. Right, so that's what it is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to us, don't worry, it looks really bad, but you remove the stones, you're going to find the hidden Amorite treasures. So it struck me that how could it be that it's the same Saras. Yet when the Torah first begins the discussion of Saras in number 6, again, it's a dramatic punishment. It's a dramatic punishment. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, understand, by the way, the overwhelming nature of tzaras, right? Understand what it meant. It's not just the pshat that you couldn't get a haircut and you had to let your hair grow. You were isolated from your family. And what else? You were publicly shamed. You can't hide tzaras. It's not the pshat that you can wear long sleeves. You're isolated. You are taken out. You are taken out of the community and you are put on the periphery. For how long? It's a case-by-case situation. You can't. The coin has to come to see you. You're cut off from your family. You're cut off from your friends. You're cut off from your community. It's a highly public, overwhelming, shameful experience. Again, a purposeful one, but one that's overwhelming nevertheless. Understand, there's a similar dynamic, by the way, with Mun. I think, did I mention this? Maybe less? Right. So remember, again, Klal Yisrael complains about the man, which out of all in the desert, out of all the complaints of Klal Yisrael, that seems to be the most illegitimate one, right? Man was the greatest gift of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's take out every single day, no trans fat, right? Whatever you want it to be, tastes like whatever you want, exactly what you need. Why would Klal Yisrael complain against that? Complain about that. So remember, the Gemara says that the man was also a litmus test of your personal piety. If a person was righteous, the man fell at your doorstep. You weren't so righteous, you know, a block away, really in big trouble, you know, next town over. So when you woke up in the morning and everybody wakes up to go ahead and, you know, collect their man, and you and Mr. Schwartz walk out at the same time, and his man is right there, and your man is a football field away, that's embarrassing. That's embarrassing. To live under the spiritual microscope, on one hand, is a gift, because you get immediate divine feedback. On the other hand, for most people, is incredibly overwhelming. So man, tsara'as, was all of this same idea. Immediate, instantaneous, and sometimes significant divine feedback. So what was amazing to note is the following. That here we have tsara'as, which again, was clearly an onesh, clearly a punishment, and a significant one. And yet here, tsara'as is used as a mechanism to open the doors of wealth for Klal Yisrael. Apparently we wouldn't have found that wealth on our own. So now HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts tsara'as in the home. I have to remove the stones. And when I remove the stones, I'm able to find the treasure. So there's an incredible dialectic within tsara'as. So is tsara'as good? Is tsara'as not good? Is tsara'as a punishment? Is tsara'as a reward? And how could it be that tsara'as on my body is treated one way, but yet the same tsara'as when it appears in my home is treated a different way? So one more detour in the parasha. The Torah says as follows, look at number 12. So to appreciate tsara'as, we're going to go to the beginning of Tazria, which are the laws of childbirth. Ubimlo'os yomei tara labeinu labas, tavi keves ben shnaso li'ola, so interestingly enough, without getting into all of the sacrificial details, when a woman gives birth, she has to bring two karbanos. She has to bring an ola, which is a burnt offering, right? Totally burnt on the Mizbeach. And she has to bring a chatos. Now a chatos is a sin offering. So the obvious question that the Gemara deals with is, why does a woman who gave birth, why would she have to bring a sin offering? What's the sinful nature? So the Gemara says something amazing. Take a look at number 13. Shalu Tamidim es Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. So the students asked Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Right? Pretty amazing. Rashbi, almost like Baomer. So that's Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Mipnei ma amra Torah, yoledes mivia karban. Why does the Torah say that a woman who gives birth has to bring a sin offering? So the Gemara says, Amr lahen, bisha shakora'atz leleid, kofetzes v'nishba'as shelo tezakek labayla. Lefichach amra Torah, tavi korban. Because Rav Shimon ben Yochai says that very often, a woman who is in the throes of childbirth, where the pain is incredibly intense, swears that she will never ever do this again. Right? Swears that I'm not going to be with my husband. I'm not going through this pain again. I'm not going through this pain again. So essentially, she makes a false oath. She makes a false oath. The penalty for making a false oath is a karban chatos. It's a sin offering. So because she makes that false oath, so she brings a karban chatos. So I'll share with you something amazing. Take a look at number 15. So this is from the sichos of Rav Nevenzau. Rav Nevenzau is one of the great rabbanim in the old city of Yerushalayim, a Talmid Mufak of Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach. And Rav Nevenzau has a beautiful piece about this. He says, take a look at number 15, paragraph Aleph. V'yesh lahavin, halotziri ha'leitahim achin ke'evim chazokim ma'od, ke'evim azim, shanaviyim mishtamshim bohem leter mahalchim kashim she'ke'evim rav. Obviously, the pains of childbirth are quite significant. So significant that, remember again, the Navi, when he wants to describe the difficult circumstances of the Messianic era, compares the arrival of Mashiach to childbirth. Okay, so obviously, if that's the comparison, we know that va'ishar yodas heitiv shegambalei dehaba yofiu shuv osam ke'evei tofos imkein maduahi mischarata. So Rav Nevenzau asks a simple question. So let's play this out. So we just said that a woman brings a chatas offering after giving birth. Why? Because the assumption is that during some point in time during the labor, I guess this is also pre-epidural days, right? So sometime during the process of the labor, she swore that she's never going through this again. After the birth, she realizes, okay, Meretz Hashem, I still hope to build my family. She's going to go through it again. So it turns out she made a false oath. So Rav Nevenzau asks an interesting question. He says, so why is it that if the woman knows the pain of childbirth, Why does she go through it again? See, only this is a man's question, by the way. Just understand. No, in all seriousness, you're going to see why, because the answer is uniquely feminine. Right. So from a man's perspective, I don't understand. If I know that something hurts, I don't do it again. So if she knows that it's going to hurt, so why go through this process again? So if it's because she says to herself, well, you know what? The pain wasn't so bad. So remember again, a woman brings a carbon chatos after every single birth. Every time she gives birth, she brings the chatos, which tells you what? Right? She forgets, or that she goes ahead and she makes the same oath every single time she's in labor. Right? Every single time. I mean, again, whether the pain changes, the pain doesn't, it's uncomfortable enough that apparently the Ribbono Shel Olam felt that a woman makes this type of shua, this type of oath, every single time she is giving birth. Let's turn the page. Skip down a little bit. So paragraph Dalid. He says, "Madua chozeres lady." Fine, skip down. Elisha achin, davar lo nishtana b'dasa isha. So Rav Nevin Zal says something amazing. So, if the pain is so intense during childbirth that the Torah assumes that a woman in some way swears some type of oath that she's never going to. But I want to point this out. This is not just like a cute thing that she swears she's never going to have a baby again. This is. If the Torah is requiring a woman to bring a carbon, bringing a carbon is a very, very, very serious obligation. And bringing non-sanctified sacrificial items to the Beis HaMikdash is a very serious, which means, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is mandating the carbon, it means the Ribbono Shel Olam who created us understands that this is what a woman is going to do during childbirth. This is the natural, reflexive behavior of a woman during childbirth. Doesn't mean that everyone does it, no. But it means that Ribbono Shel Olam understood that it happens enough that he mandates the karban. So again, if it happens enough that it's a mandated karban, after the first birth, second birth, seventh birth, it keeps on happening. So what is it, says Rav Nevin Zal, that causes a woman to once again want to build her family? What's the pshat? She says something amazing. She'achin she'davar lo nishtana b'dasa isha. The truth is, nothing really changes. Gam la'achar shivu'ayim merega ha'leida, hi'odas b'vados, kifi she'yoda miyad b'tos ha'leida harishona, she'gam b'leida ha'boya ke'ev gadol. So Rav Nevin Zal doesn't subscribe to the forgetfulness theory. He says a woman is acutely aware of the pain that she endured, and she's acutely aware that she's going to have that pain in every subsequent delivery as well. So ma'ishtana, so what changed? This is such a profound statement. Hisrachakus mirega haleda. What changed? Hisrachakus mirega haleda means the distance of time between where she is now and the moment when she was in labor. So what changed? Perspective when she was in the throes of labor. So again, all she was enveloped by the pain. That's all she had was the pain. As time goes on and she becomes distanced from the labor, hisrachakus mirega haleda, she is endowed with perspective. What's the perspective? Bishas maisa. At the time of the labor itself, when the pain is intense, meaning Rav Nevin Zal says, at the time when she's in active labor, she's only focused on one thing, which is pain, or pain management, or how long will this pain, or how long can I deal with this pain? There's not really much thought about anything that's going to come out, or anything that's going to be after the pain. The focus is on the pain. Paragraph A. Ach ka'avor shivua shivu'ayim. So Rav Nevin Zal says, after 1 or 2 weeks, I don't know, I guess the time changes per person. Ha'isha roes pnei hadvarim acheres. A woman is able to see things in a different perspective. Tefugas ha'ke'ev. When the pain begins to subside, ma'afsharas la lachzar v'lochush es hayofi shebechai hamishpacha. As the pain subsides, she is able to see the beauty in family life. She's able to see the beauty in being a mother. She's able to see the beauty in having a mishpacha. Laharich mechadash es ha'oneg hanafshi shebegidol hatinok. When the pain begins to subside, she's able to focus on the beauty of raising that little baby. The proof to this change of perspective is that she's willing to go ahead and have more children. So Rav Nevenzal says it could be that maybe over time a woman forgets the acuteness of the pain. Maybe I don't know, I can't weigh in on such issues. But one thing is clear, which says Rav Nevenzal, is with the passage of time, there's a different perspective. B'shas Maisa, in the moment of the delivery, the focus is wholly and solely on the pain and the alleviation of the pain. So I swear, I'm never going to do this again, because who wants to willingly endure pain? But as time goes on, there's a different perspective. As I am distanced, as the woman is distanced, ultimately again from the moments of birth, there's a different perspective that allows her to see the beauty in what it means to have a mishpacha. So why am I sharing this with you? Because what Rav Nevenzal is telling us is as follows. That, and really what the Torah is teaching us is an incredible idea, which is that sometimes you need a bit of distance in order to find proper perspective. So when the woman is at the time in the throes of labor, when she's b'shas maisa, which again, being in the throes of labor is just a metaphor for being in the thick of it of life, right? In the middle of that pain, I don't see anything but the alleviation of my pain. Just make it stop. Just somehow, again, allow me to breathe normally and allow me to get through this difficult circumstance. But then when there's a little bit of distance between myself and the painful episode, I'm able to find a dramatically different perspective. Does it take away the pain? The pain is still there. There's still a recognition of the pain. There's still a reality of the pain, and that reality doesn't change. But there's a different perspective now that I have a little bit of distance. Perhaps this is what the Torah is telling us with Tzara'as as well. The Torah says as follows. When the home gets Tzara'as, so what happens? What does the Torah tell? Chash Baruch Hu says, you know why I'm giving the house Tzara'as? Why am I giving the house Tzara'as? Why? Why? There's buried treasure. There's buried treasure. But sometimes to find the buried treasure in life, you have to knock down a couple of walls. Sometimes the treasure doesn't show up at your doorstep. Sometimes the treasure doesn't just present itself. You have to knock down walls. You have to pull out stones. You have to do heavy lifting. But if you're willing to knock down the walls of life, you could find beautiful treasure. And the truth is, that's what Tzara'as is all about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, really what I want you to do is, I want you to look at the end of the parasha first and then go back and relearn the beginning. Because the end of the parasha tells us what Tzara'as is really about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu visits, the Moshe loves us. Loves us so much. And the Ribbono Shel Olam does not sit there. You know, so many of us have such a flawed chinuch, and have unfortunately, again, passed down that flawed chinuch to our children about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu feels. HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us. You think you love your kids, you think you love your spouse, you think you love your parents. As much as you love the person you love most in this world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves each of us 1,000 times more. He doesn't wait for us to step out of line so he could patch us. He doesn't wait to go out and give us. Anytime HaKadosh Baruch Hu visits adversity upon us, it's for one reason. Because he loves us. And I'm not saying that as a cliche way. I mean, what Tzara'as is, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, there's buried treasure you have to find. Sometimes the buried treasure is in your house. Sometimes the buried treasure is in your heart. But the problem is there are so many walls that we put up that prevent us from accessing the treasure. What does Tzara'as do? Tzara'as is the mechanism by which we knock down the walls of life. Tzara'as is the mechanism by which you knock down the walls to find the buried treasure. So in Tzara'as of your home, that is a literal statement. There's Tzara'as on the walls. Why is my home getting Tzara'as? So I can pull out the stones and find the treasure. That is the same thing when HaKadosh Baruch Hu visits Tzara'as upon the individual. What is the Ribbono Shel Olam saying? He's saying, my beautiful child, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're so magnificent. You're so wonderful. You're so heilig. You're so special. And why are you using your time and energy to deconstruct others? You should be using that same time and energy to construct and to build up yourself. So here's what I'm going to do. I need you to stop what you're doing. I need you to knock down your walls. And I need you to find the treasure that's buried inside of you. So what does Kadosh Baruch Hu do? Kadosh Baruch Hu says, most of us have difficulty finding our buried treasure. Do you know why? Because we're too busy. Everyone is busy. What are you busy with? I have no idea, but I have no time to talk about it, right? Everyone's busy. Everyone's busy. Most people are not legitimately busy. Most people are busy with things that they should not be busy with. That's a separate share, different discussion. Everyone's busy. And because when I'm busy, so there's no time to look for the buried treasure. There's no time to look for the treasure. So what does Kadosh Baruch Hu do? Kadosh Baruch Hu plucks me out of everyday life, plants me outside the camp. And what's my job? I have one simple job. I know the community supports me. Somebody sends me meals. There's like a take a meal link for the guy who's saras, right? So I'm provided for. I'm not going to work, right? I'm assuming like in biblical Israel, there's paid time off for saras as well. So again, I'm stuck outside the camp. I'm stuck outside the camp. So what do I do? What do I do? What's my job? My job is to knock down the walls and find the treasure within. My goal is to try to figure out where did I go wrong? Because I can't spend my life focusing on others. I need to figure out what makes me special. I need to figure out how to activate my kohos. I need to figure out how I could use who I am and what I am to build up others. Not chas v'shalom to deconstruct them. But what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? The Ribon Shalom says that sometimes in life, you need a little bit of distance in order to be able to gain proper perspective. Sometimes that's why, again, the tsaras of the home is an easy message that all of us could absorb, right? That sounds beautiful. God puts saras ultimately on the stones so that I remove the stones and what? And what? Find the treasure in it. Why do none of us have any difficulty absorbing that message, that lesson? Why not? Because it's removed. Because it's removed. Because it's on the house. It's not me. Whenever you could see things across, right? Whenever you could see things outside of you, it's always easier to absorb those messages. When something is embedded within me, those are the more difficult messages. Yes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the message of tsaras is all contained in the message of home tsaras. The point of home tsaras is, I'm going to put tsaras on the walls so that you knock down the walls to find the treasure. I'm going to put tsaras on you so that you knock down the walls to find the treasure as well. But sometimes in life, it's all about being able just to regain proper perspective. Let's go back to the kapitel for just a moment. So David HaMelech again is broken, and David HaMelech is angry, and David HaMelech is upset, and David HaMelech feels forsaken, and he feels betrayed. And in the first 11 psukim of this particular kapitel, what is David HaMelech doing? He's mamish railing against the Rishayim. He's wishing the worst kinds of death and destruction upon all of his enemies. By the way, bless you, who are people who he knows, right? Who are people, bless you, who are fellow tribal members. But he's wishing, and then what happens at the end? David HaMelech, Vayomer Adam, I'm back in number one, Pasuk Yudbeis, Vayomer Adam Ach Pri Latzadik. David HaMelech says, the righteous man has reward. You know what happened in this last Pasuk here? You know what happened last Pasuk? David HaMelech took a deep cleansing breath. David HaMelech went ahead and said, okay, I'm now at a crossroads. I can allow myself to go ahead and be consumed by the anger, by the hatred, by the animosity, and no one would have faulted him for it. Which is, I could take a step back, and I could take myself out of the camp, and I could begin to knock down the walls that I have built as a result of all of the anger, animosity, and betrayal that I have experienced. What happens in that last pasuk is David HaMelech says, Ach pri latzadik. What a strange, what does it mean? Ach, there's reward for the righteous? Oh, maybe we say about olam haba, the righteous suffer in this world. You know, the message of the righteous suffering in this world. But there's going to be a beautiful Gan Eden. I don't know about you. That message never did it for me. Never did it for me. This idea, okay, don't worry. You'll suffer here, but it'll be great in the next world. Fantastic, right? Thank you, right? That's very helpful day to day and really makes me want to get out of bed in the morning. I know I'm going to say it. Everyone thinks it, but it sounds like happy curses. But I'm just going to say, everyone thinks that, like, the goal is as long as you can have a lichter Gan Eden, olam haba could mamish be down the drain. It's not true. It's not true. So prelat tzaddik doesn't just mean, don't worry, David, you'll have a beautiful licht Gan Eden. David HaMelech says, you know what? These circumstances were visited upon me for a reason. There's hashkacha pratis. How could it be that Shaul believes me one moment, calls me his son one moment, and literally again in the next moment, some other guy has come and pointed out he's willing to kill me. He's willing to kill me. These circumstances are ordained and choreographed by the Ribono Shel Olam, and for one reason, Ach Pri Latzadik. There's some fruit from this for me. there's something in this for me. I have to figure out how these circumstances allow me to actualize as David. It's not random. It's not haphazard. It's not the leaf falling from the tree. It's not me scratching myself on the thorn bush. This could only be orchestrated by God. You know, there are some stories that are just so wild and so crazy that they could only be choreographed by the Rebbe Shlomo. This is one of these stories. It doesn't make any sense. Father-in-law and son-in-law reconcile. I'm not going to kill you. You're not going to kill me. Again, sometimes that's how families are. Let's just not kill each other. Shalom Yisrael. It's fantastic. And then 5 minutes later, everything falls apart. It doesn't make sense. So Daniel says, I have a choice. And the choice is, I could become angry. I could become disillusioned. I could continue to build up my walls, or I can knock down my walls and find the treasure buried inside. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu is visiting these circumstances upon me, it means that somehow, some way, He is trying to teach me some type of lesson. There is something to be learned. There is something to be gleaned. That's the Ach Pri Latzadik. So what happens at the end of the kapitel? David HaMelech chooses to alter his perspective. In Psukim Aleph through Yud Aleph, it's angry David. Angry David wants revenge. Angry David wants vengeance. Angry David wants to see a punishing God swoop down and mete out swift and decisive justice to all those who have wronged him, and rightfully so. And in Pasuk Yud Beis is prospective David. And prospective David says, wait. Wait, this whole thing can't be about making me an angry person. This whole thing can't be about making me disillusioned with humanity and unable to forge any type of feeling of real relationships because of a fear of betrayal. There has to be more to this. If the Ribono Shel Olam is constantly knocking down the walls all around me, it's only for one reason, which is there's hidden treasure somewhere. I just have to figure out what the hidden treasure of these circumstances are. I have to figure out what the hidden treasure of these circumstances is. And how I find that treasure, how I use that treasure, that's going to be the pri. That's going to be the fruit that the tzaddik, that I, the righteous individual, will glean from these circumstances. And herein lies the greatness of David HaMelech. The fact that we all have moments when we are disillusioned, and the fact that we all have moments when we're consumed by anger and by rage, the good thing is we're not alone. Apparently, David HaMelech had those moments as well. But you know what makes great people great? You see, today we have a tendency to deify our great people, right? The goal is to make our great people as unhuman as possible, right? Every single Gadol Hadar was sleeping in the bench on a Beis Medrash by the time he was 2.5 years old, right? No one played outside, right? No one ever misbehaved. Everyone was a malach from the age, which, of course, and that's why you have so many disillusioned young people, because there are no more real role models, because everybody is Moshe Rabbeinu, and everybody was an Elui from the time that they were kids, and no one ever got into trouble, no one ever misbehaved, and no one played any pranks. So, okay, if that's it, then Judaism, I guess, has no more role models for our youth. It's a real issue today. It's a real challenge. The beautiful part is that it's totally false. Even great people go through incredible struggles. And the proof is, lest you think I'm telling you a story, you could just open up to Kapitel Nunches. David HaMelech says, I'm angry. I'm angry, and I'm hurt, and I'm disillusioned, and I'm upset, and I hate everyone, and I wish death upon them. Literally, again, I wish death upon them. I hope the Malach HaMavis wakes, I hope they find him at the head of his bed tonight. That's what Malach wants for his enemies. And then he works through it, and at the end of the capital he says, no, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that person. If these are my circumstances, and the walls are constantly being knocked down around me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to find the treasure. He wants me to find the pri. And herein lies the greatness of David HaMelech. That when the walls get knocked down, what he does is he looks for the buried treasure inside and does not lose himself to the anger, to the pain, to the disillusionment of difficult circumstances. That was the koach of David HaMelech. That's the koach of Kapitel Nunches. And halavai we should be zochet to glean that same koach as well. I don't understand what